time. So to move right along, our first presentation is by Dr. Tony Hawkridge from the University of Cape Town. He's the clinical director of the South African TB Vaccine Initiative, and will be reporting on the results of a BCG trial comparing percutaneous and intradermal administration.
Thank you, Larry, and good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for the opportunity to report on this trial, which we've been conducting for the last 5.5 to 6 years. I started off as the chief clinical medical officer on the trial. Mark Hatherall took over from me about a year ago, and Larry Garter and Greg Hussey were the co-principal and principal investigator on the trial, respectively. Greg is not here, unfortunately. He missed his connection, and I think he's sitting in a transit lounge somewhere in Johannesburg. So, in his absence. Anyway, the background to this trial is that in the 1990s, South Africa contemplated and then in 2000 made the changeover from percutaneous to intradermal vaccine. From the 1970s onward, we'd been vaccinating with Tokyo BCG, locally produced and with tools which were also locally manufactured, and we switched over to intradermal Danish BCG, which was imported. And the committee that made the recommendation to the health department to make the change recognized at the time that the decision was based as much on practical, political, and economic considerations as it was on any scientific data, and actually encouraged the TB vaccine research community in South Africa and beyond to look at the question further and more closely. And that's the question of the efficacy and safety of the one route as opposed to the other. So the study was conceived, and the primary objective, which I've listed here, was to compare the efficacy of the one route with the other. We used in this study Tokyo 172 BCG, which was donated to us by the Tokyo BCG lab, and I'm happy to say that Dr. Koyama is at the conference and present here this afternoon. And we used it for one reason, was that this was one of the strains which was available in both formulations. And the endpoint of the trial was the prevention of TB, and with specific criteria, diagnostic criteria, which I'll explain a little bit further. But another very important reason to do the trial was two really. One was to develop capacity at the trial site in order to be ready for phase three trials of new TB vaccines, which were envisaged. And the second was to allow us to perform a nested case control study looking at immune correlates of protection against TB following BCG vaccination, and that study is ongoing. In this slide, I've tried to summarize the main elements of the design of the study. We started in March 2001, and it took us about 3.5 years to enroll. We enrolled antenatally, so we targeted pregnant women at the antenatal clinics, and that's the reason why we enrolled 13,338 mothers, but eventually only vaccinated 11,680 infants. Randomization was by week of birth, balanced every 8 weeks, and you can see the numbers there are roughly even. And then surveillance was a mixture of active and passive surveillance. There was fairly active surveillance during the first 3 months of life for reactogenicity, essentially. And then there was a more passive surveillance for the first 2 years of life, looking at TB, but also at mortality and morbidity. We had a system set up with the TB hospital in the region, which was geared to verify the diagnosis of TB. So we had what we called the case verification ward, where we admitted children who were contacts or suspects for diagnosis. And then there was, of course, a review process looking at all SAEs, but also all cases, all deaths, and classifying them and looking at BCG and TB relatedness and the resolution. So here I've just tried to outline the main elements of our surveillance system. There were two main sort of follow-up events which could be triggered. One was a mortality follow-up, which entailed primarily a verbal autopsy, but also a review of the case notes and the death certificates and trying to put our finger on what the cause of death was. And the other was what we called a TB follow-up, which involved contacting the family, a home visit, and verifying whether the child was in fact a contact, the signs and symptoms of TB, and importantly whether the child had recovered and recovered fully from the reason why he or she was admitted to hospital. And to get the data to trigger those events, we made regular checks with the Department of Home Affairs, with all the hospitals in the regions, checked the TB register, checked the lab registers for adult sputum-positive cases. And because we had this nested case control study, which had enrolled about half of the children in the trial, we used that opportunity to also look for contacts and suspects. And we set the bar fairly low. So any child who even sniffed vaguely of TB, the mother was invited to bring the child for admission to our ward and underwent diagnostic verification. And these are the elements of diagnosis that we had. Obviously, a history and physical examination. They got a chest X-ray, a tuberculin skin test, and HIV testing with pre- and post-counseling. We chased the microbiological side energetically. Shortly before we started our study, a study at Red Cross Children's Hospital had shown the usefulness of induced sputa in children and young children. And so we elected to do two gastric washings and two induced sputa on every child who was admitted. And those were all sent for culture. We did drug susceptibility on any positive culture and molecular typing to exclude non-tuberculous mycobacterial disease as well as BCG disease. And then there was a review process, particularly for the X-rays, because they are so difficult to interpret. We had we were fortunate to have specialists in the Western Cape who are world authorities on the interpretation of childhood TB X-rays. We developed a diagnostic algorithm, which was used in our final analysis, and then the children were classified into the standard categories of definite, probable, possible, unlikely, and not TB. And these are the this is just a simplified look at the classification. Essentially, the definite cases were those who were culture positive, regardless of what else they had. Probables and possibles had suggestive chest X-rays. Probables with clinical and or epidemiological support, and possibles with less support. And then the unlikely cases were children who had been diagnosed as TB and started on TB treatment by their attending physician, but when we reviewed the case, there was not that much clinical or radiological support for the diagnosis. Just to remind us that this was an equivalence trial. And the way that we interpreted the results was that we designated the intradermal route as the reference route and the percutaneous route as the comparator. And to demonstrate equivalence, the 95%, well, it's a 95.5% confidence interval around the point estimate of the comparator, that is the percutaneous route, had to fall within the predefined margin of minus delta to plus delta. And for this trial, we used a 25% margin. So in the slides that I'll show you with the primary analysis results, that is how we interpreted equivalence or the lack thereof. Other things about the results that I'll show you, they're all for the intention to treat analysis, and they are all for events which occurred during the first 2 years of the child's life. And you'll notice that the confidence intervals are 95.5% and not 95%, and this is to adjust for the two interim analyses which were performed as part of the data safety monitoring plan for the trial. And this is your standard table one, just to show you that the two groups that were randomized were similar in some important aspects such as gender, gestational age at birth, the proportion that were preterm, some issues around the birth, birth weight, ethnicity, and the maternal age. No obvious differences there. These are the overall outcomes. This particular slide shows you the cumulative incidence over 2 years. The following four slides that I'll show you show the incidence rate, so just so that we don't get confused with that. But you'll see here that if you add the definite, the probable, and possible for both routes, the cumulative incidence over 2 years was 6.3%, or around about 3% per year. And for culture-positive cases, it was 1.47% or about 0.7% per year. Now, there are different ways of cutting and slicing the data. What I've done here is give you four analyses. The first is looking at definite, probable, and possible cases together. The second is just definite and probable. Then I'll look at definite. And then the fourth one is including the externally diagnosed cases, and I'll explain that a little bit later. And so you can see the red dotted lines here are 25% above and 25% below the point estimate for the intradermal group. And the interpretation is that you look at the 95.5% confidence interval around this rate here, and if it falls within that margin, then we've demonstrated equivalence. So we demonstrated equivalence for definite probables and possibles. When you remove the possibles, you don't quite demonstrate equivalence, because the upper bound of the confidence interval around the percutaneous point estimate just sticks out of the margin there. When you look at definites only, again, we demonstrated equivalence. The entire confidence interval here lies within the margin. Now, although we did our level best to make sure that every child who was diagnosed with TB or suspected with TB in the area passed through our system of case verification, there were inevitably some children who were diagnosed outside. Some of these were diagnosed in referral hospitals, teaching hospitals outside of our area, and some of them simply slipped through the net. So you may remember from the previous three slides ago, the total for definite, probable, and possible for children who went through our system was around 730. So there were an extra 60 cases who were diagnosed outside. Obviously, the quality of the data for these cases was not exactly the same as the quality of the data for children diagnosed in the CV ward, and so we didn't include them in the primary analysis, but we thought it would be interesting just to add them in and see if it made any difference, and it doesn't make any difference. We still demonstrate equivalence. So those are the primary efficacy results for the trial. I'll now move on to the safety results. In terms of the local reaction to the vaccine, it's difficult to compare because the methods of giving the vaccine are so different. In the percutaneous, it's a multipunctured tool which was used twice in two different places, and the intradermal is obviously a single injection. So it's not that meaningful to talk about the size of the ulcer or the amount of swelling. But the one thing which we did look at was the occurrence of keloids. There seemed to be slightly more in the intradermal group, but it wasn't statistically significant. And then what would be of interest to many, just at the BCG safety meeting before this, the occurrence of suppurative lymphadenitis, which is a well-known complication of BCG administration. We saw a very low rate. Only five children developed significant suppurative lymphadenitis. This is in the ipsilateral axilla to the vaccination site out of the total of 11,680. Which is 0.02%, and the split was 2 in the intradermal group and 3 in the percutaneous group, which you would predict is not statistically significant. And then we had one child who developed disseminated BCG disease. This is a child who was known to us. He had had a number of admissions to hospital with malnutrition and a chest infection and then osteomyelitis, and ended up being referred to Tigerberg Hospital, which is a quaternary academic hospital, and was worked up there. And part of the workup was that they repeated the gastric washings for TB culture and grew a mycobacterium. And because they are interested in BCG disease and have the infrastructure to do molecular typing, the isolate was typed, and it turned out to be BCG. This child was actually HIV negative, and on further investigation turned out to have a primary immunodeficiency. And that's the only case of disseminated BCG disease that we are aware of, and obviously the numbers are very small and not the difference is not statistically significant. Looking at the morbidity picture, this is hospitalizations. There were some over 3,000 admissions to hospital. And if you count the number of children who were admitted at least once, it's 2,181. Now, each one of those hospitalizations was documented and followed up. And what I've given you here is the breakdown for all causes and then trying to look by ICD-10 code at the various diagnostic categories, so infectious disease, nutritional disease, CNS disease, and so on. And the long and the short of it is that there was no difference between the routes in any of those categories. There were 187 deaths, that is, of the 11,680 infants who were vaccinated. 187 of them died before their second birthday, which is a rate of 1.6%. And on first glance, it looks like there were quite a lot more in the intradermal group than the percutaneous group. But again, statistically, that didn't turn out to be significant. We then looked at the deaths. So each of those deaths was reviewed by Dr. Moya, who's in the audience here. And a primary cause of death, as well as a contributory cause of death, was assigned. And we then looked at the deaths by cause of death. And again, there were no differences between the groups when you looked at infectious deaths, respiratory deaths, perinatal deaths, and so on. We did a per-protocol analysis as well, which didn't change the picture. And we did look at the extrapulmonary cases of TB. The numbers were very small. There were seven extrapulmonary cases in total. Four of them were TB meningitis. One was miliary, one abdominal, and one spinal TB. And with such small numbers, you're not going to demonstrate statistical significance. And the split was fairly even anyway. I can show you that table later if you want. And then just to emphasize that the last follow-up was only done a month or two ago, and the database was only closed a couple of weeks ago. So this data is very fresh, and obviously secondary analyses are ongoing and will be ongoing for some time to come. So what are the conclusions from this study? In a nutshell, we didn't find any significant differences between the intradermal route of BCG vaccination and the percutaneous route in terms of either safety or efficacy in preventing TB in young children and infants. And we feel that the policy implications are that the international bodies, and primarily here we're talking about the WHO, should not be recommending the intradermal route above the percutaneous route. They should be recommending either route, and that national vaccination programs would then be free to choose which route to use in their country or in their district or in their province based on the other things which are important, which are things like the cost of the vaccine, how easy it is to procure a particular vaccine or the tool that you're using to give it, what sort of training exists or what sort of training needs to be undertaken in order to change over if that's what's contemplated, and how easy it is to administer the vaccine by one route or the other route. There are a vast number of people who've contributed to this study. I'd like to just highlight the statisticians. That's Francesca Little in Cape Town and Peggy Goetz at ARIS, and the data managers, Leslie Workman and Angela West, who've done a sterling job. Also, Dr. Jerry Sadoff and the ARIS Global TB Vaccine Foundation, who funded this study from the start. And I'm also like to just acknowledge and thank the Tokyo BCG Laboratory, who, as I said, supplied the vaccine and the tools for the trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we can then take a few minutes for questions or clarification from Dr. Hawkridge, if there are any comments. Renee?
Yes, I have a quick question. It's about the definition of equivalence being 25% or less difference. In a disease that is not particularly rare, difference of 25% efficacy could actually amount to a large number of cases. Are you going to take that down at all and look at maybe 15 or 10%? as a definition of equivalence, a difference of only that much? Do you follow my question?
I do follow that question. I'm considering whether to defer to Dr. Gaiter on this. But we haven't specifically considered looking at different definitions of delta, but I think it would be interesting to do so.
It may be standard, but it could actually translate into a large number of cases.
Well, a plus minus 25% efficacy in an equivalency analysis actually is quite broad. It was chosen because a priori we looked at the incidence rates and we were looking at what did we have a reasonable power to demonstrate given the number of kids that we thought that we could enroll. And so that was the reason that we chose it. I think, though, that if you take a look at this, that, even with nearly 12,000 kids enrolled, we end up with 200 cases, which split between two routes, doesn't give you really tight confidence intervals around your points. But if you just look at the point estimates and the comparison of the point estimates, actually they are quite close, regardless of which definition you use. And we did a blinded analysis first, to look at it so that if it didn't, if the point estimates were different but you didn't show non-equivalence, would we still want to make a comment that even though a priori it didn't meet our definition, but we looked at it and, again, that in some definitions it's, two definitions, intradermal comes out better, one definition percutaneous comes out better, the point estimates are pretty close no matter what definition you use. So I think our conclusion is that the two routes of administration are essentially identical. Ford?
Ford von Ryan, U.S. Very nice and impressive study. One question. It's interesting that your analysis would come out differently if you took definite and probable versus definite, probable, and possible. And I may have missed it, but what was your predefined endpoint? Was it definite and probable?
No, the predefined was definite, probable, and possible.
I see.
In the statistical analysis plan. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, Anikea Singh from South Africa. Tony, your group has recently shown that if you compare the previous vaccination policy, which was percutaneous Tokyo strain, versus the more recent strain and administration method in South Africa, which is Danish strain intradermal, that there was actually a reduction in incidence of tuberculosis using the Danish strain intradermally. So I'd like you to comment on that. And secondly, in this trial, how was the percutaneous vaccination actually administered? Because I understand that there are different ways of delivering percutaneous and that may actually have a huge effect. It may not be necessarily translatable into large global policies in terms of clinical trial administration versus large operational administration. If you could comment on that.
Sure. Thank you for the question. The study to which Dr. Hessling's referring is a large observational study which we undertook in Cape Town. As I said, there was a changeover in 2000 from percutaneous Tokyo to intradermal Danish, and it was a before and after observational study looking at the incidence with the one root and strain as opposed to the other root and the other strain. And that study showed that there was the rate of severe and complicated TB in the intradermal Danish group was slightly lower than with the percutaneous Japanese group. But that study has all the problems of an observational study. So was it the root, was it the strain, or was it something else that happened in the meantime, such as the HIV prevalence changing, that sort of thing? So we've always been a bit guarded about interpretation of that study. The issue of how the percutaneous vaccine was given, we tried to do everything exactly as to manufacturer's instructions. And so the Tokyo BCG laboratory sent over two senior staff at the start of the trial. Dr. Koyama was one of them and Dr. Nakada was the other, who came and actually participated in training the staff in the Western Cape who would be giving the vaccinations and satisfied themselves that it was being given the proper way. And the way that they do it is slightly different to the way that we do it in South Africa. They press once and then actually lift the tool up and then go down a second time and press it again. So for the percutaneous route, you actually get two vaccination wounds and subsequently vaccination scars. Would it be practical to do that in a public health setting in South Africa? I don't see why not. It would just it would just require retraining, and we had to retrain to switch to intradermal anyway. So, yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, we'll move on. Thank you very much, Tony. And it's then my privilege and pleasure to introduce Dr. Gerald Sadoff, co-chair for the session, also my boss and the chief executive officer and president of the ARIS Global TB Vaccine Foundation. He will be talking about ARIS approaches on recombinant BCG and an adenovirus 35 vectored vaccine. On the title.
Title. Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a real thrill to see so many people in the audience. I'm sure they came to hear Tony, and now they're just staying around for the science part. But we really enjoy having you, and we want to be able to encourage the use of new tools, especially vaccines, in the control of the epidemic. Well, our strategy at ARIS is to have a new regimen to supplant the current BCG regimen, which I will talk about in a minute. And our idea is to take and change, use either the current BCG or make a new BCG, a recombinant BCG, and then boost it with either a protein, an adjuvant, a viral vector, or an oral vaccine that we've invented one or two times. And the basis of this idea is that most all the pediatric vaccines are given in more than one dose, and it's expecting a lot for a single dose given at birth of a vaccine to protect all the way through all of the pediatric age range and the adult age range. And second of all, from immunologic and animal studies, it appears that a prime boost regimen is the single best way of inducing the kinds of cellular immunity that's required for TB, and this comes from a variety of studies, not only in TB, but in the HIV field and the malaria field. So I've just listed here the leading candidates for efficacy testing in this regimen. There's many other candidates, but these are the ones that are either in clinical trials right now or about to go into clinical trials in the 2006-2007 timeframe. And for BCG prime, there's our vaccine, which I'm going to talk about a little bit, ARIS X03 Endosome Escape. There's a strain from the Max Planck, which has been licensed to a German group. And then there's a strain, the Albert Einstein, which is an attenuated TB. For recombinant fusion proteins, there's the GSK vaccine, the Staten Serum Institute. There's several versions of the Staten Serum Institute vaccine, and Peter Anderson's here. I'll talk about that. And then there's recombinant viral vector boosts. Leading one, the Oxford MVA-85A, the ARIS Crucell 402 AD35, which I'll talk about today, and then our oral vaccine. Now, I'd like to take this opportunity to announce the fact that the Dutch government has recently, just yesterday, given ARIS a very large grant of 18 million euros to support this work. So we're very pleased that we've been able to engender that kind of support to go forward with these vaccine candidates. That will be a great help to us. Now, as you know, BCG was invented over a long period of time between 1906 and 1921, passing the strain on a mixture of bile and potatoes in order that it finally became attenuated and could be used. But it is a very old vaccine. There's been a number of studies done with BCG, and although the vaccine is one of the most widely used vaccines in the world, it has a very variable efficacy, as shown by these studies, where if you can see this is zero efficacy, and this is positive and this is negative. And one of the most recent trials in the 1970s and 80s from Chingleput in almost 300,000 volunteers showed less than a point estimate below zero. So clearly, BCG, although it has its benefits, is not showing reliable or consistent protection against primary infection. So why do we still use it? A series of studies that have been summarized in the literature show that miliary tuberculosis has a very good efficacy, as well as tuberculosis meningitis. And so it's a vaccine that needs to be used but can be improved in our view. And I think that the data shows that somewhere between 40 and 100,000 lives of children are saved every year by the use of BCG. So in no way do we think that BCG should not be used, but it should be substituted for with something better. Now, we started our program working with a recombinant BCG, RBCG30, that was made by Marcus Horwitz at UCLA, and its overexpression was mediated by a multicopy plasmid, which also contained the hygromycin resistance gene, and this is going to become important later in the story. But it had shown in many animal studies, especially the long-term guinea pig challenge study, that compared to the parent strain tice that it was made from, it gave increased protection. This is the kind of study that is done. You vaccinate with tice or a sham vaccine, and then challenge 10 weeks later, and then kill the animals and measure how many colony-forming units are in the lung and look at the pathology. And this is an example of looking at the lungs, livers, from animals that were given a sham vaccine. In each place where there's a white point is where there's a granuloma that can be seen. You can see that BCG dramatically reduces from control, and likewise the RBCG30, although still showing lesions and colony-forming units, is improved over BCG. And so based on this data and other data, we went forward and had the Korean Institute of Tuberculosis prepare for us under GMP a vaccine that could be used in using. And this was prepared using the standard BCG methods, which will become important later as well. The vaccine passed all the standard BCG release tests, was given a dose of 5 times 10 to the 5th intradermal in 0.1 ml. The organism viability is about 10%. In other words, if you count the number of bodies in the vaccine and then see how many are alive, there's one alive for every 10 dead. So that's important also. And this is pretty standard for vaccines for BCG, which range about 10 to 30% viability. So we did the trial with Danhoff and Thomas Littlejohn. 30 subjects were enrolled at two sites in the phase one trial. The vaccine was shown to be safe and well tolerated. And data from 17 of these subjects using the Willem-Hannequin test that he invented, who's now in South Africa, for looking for cellular immune responses against 85B at the time of collection were fixed, frozen, and then later run. These are the results from this analysis for CD4 cells. And you can see that for CD4s, this is the TICE parent versus the results that we get from the vaccine that overexpresses this antigen. We do have an increase that statistically significant, actually, compared to the parent strain. And then it's more dramatically shown for the CD8s, where once again, this is what you see following in terms of CD8 cells in humans compared to what's seen with the recombinant strain. So it looked like we had made a strain that was able to induce more antigen-specific cellular immunity against an important antigen. The problem is that when we talked with the U.S. and regulatory authorities in Europe, they said they didn't like to have a live bacteria that has a plasmid in it that has antibiotic resistance. So therefore, we had to go back and remake the strain. It was okay to test in phase one, but it would never go through all the way unless it couldn't be done any other way, and we knew that there were other ways to do it. Since we had to make the strain over again, we took the opportunity to incorporate some of the ideas that Professor Stefan Kaufman, who's here and is going to talk about it this later, had invented and decided. We incorporated that into this strain and also to make more antigens in the strain. So we incorporated endosome escape, which it means that the bug that normally goes into the cell likes to hide in the endosome, and then we use some technologies to get it out. And recently a group in the Netherlands has showed this was what TB does as well. BCG doesn't get out, but TB apparently does. So we made this strain using perfringolysin, which lyses the membrane and mediates escape from the phagosome. And it's very active. And this is just the plasmid that we constructed, that we put into BC Danish 1331, and it integrates into the chromosome, and then we're able to get a strain that expresses this perfringolysin, and it goes into a urease site so that it knocks out the ability of the organism to change the pH inside the endosome as well. And this is just a slide showing how this bug, all the places where the arrows are, it's hard to see, is where the organism actually gets out of the endosome and gets into the cytoplasm. We estimate that about 30 to 70% of the organisms break out of the cytoplasmic vacuole within about 2 hours of getting in. We then took this plasmid, took the strain that we made with endosome escape, and put these genes into this plasmid so that it could then express them. This is an example. This is the parent strain that, and this is antigen 85B. You can see it's there, and in the strain that has the plasmid in it, you can see it's much stronger. So this is just a regular gel showing on a that you can get much more expression of this gene using this technology. So then we vaccinated mice, and we looked at two different strains of mice, C57 blacks and Valpses, primed them with this bug and of either BCG or the new recombinant, then looked at immunology after sacrificing them. And here's the dramatic result that was somewhat surprising to us. In Valpses, you can see that you get responses both to BCG and to the new strain. The new strain looks like it makes a little bit more. I'm sorry, this is with BCG, you get no responses at all here, you can see. But here with the RBC strain, you're getting very good responses that are completely missing in this animal. And here you can see the RBCG, in terms of BCG, nothing, RBCG here, very good responses. So comparing this panel to this panel, you can see that the RBCG is inducing a lot more immune response. So it's actually working in a non-responsive strain. And this is the same is true if we look at the strain for expression in guinea pigs. And our collaborators have figured out a way to measure these immune responses in guinea pigs. And you can see here that in the lung and in the spleen, there's very little responses to the BCG, while the new strain makes very dramatic responses to all three of these antigens. So once again, we've demonstrated in animals that this overexpression with the endosome escape pattern is able to do this. And we get survival. Stefan had shown that his animals with the endosome escape property were actually safer in nude mice, and mice that didn't have much of an immune system. And here you can see that with BCG, after a period of time, only 16% of the animals were alive, while in these animals that have no immune systems to speak of, both of the strain, the endosome escape strain and the one that's endosome escape and overexpressing, are both having 78% alive. So these strains not only are more potent and immunogenic, but they also appear to be safer. Now, to make a strain for use in humans, we then constructed this plasmid, which we can integrate into the chromosome in the absence of antibiotic markers, which expresses a number of antigens and is able to then make a strain that we can then get rid of the antibiotic selection system through some molecular biology. I won't go through the details of using phage resolvases and make a strain that can be used in humans without antibiotics. And that strain is just about finished. And in order to produce it, we've built a factory where we can actually make BCG by fermentation rather than the old way. I don't know if you know how BCG is normally made. It's grown in bottles, put through sort of a filter because it grows like a scum on the top of the media. That's filtered, dried, broken up with steel balls, then rehydrated in lyophilized and put into lyophilization. It's a 1920s type technology. And what we've done is we've taken the opportunity to make it in fermenters where we can actually grow it. And the main thing is we can make a consistent process. And in this fermenter at Aris, we can make 300 million doses of BCG a year, which could supply the entire world. And then after harvesting, we can then dry it. And the viability on this vaccine, rather than being 10 to 20%, is 60 to 90%. So it's a process that can be cheap and can also make a lot of it. Now, let's turn to our candidate, one of the candidates we're looking at for boost, and this would be the viral vector. We chose adenovirus because adenovirus is the leading candidate in the HIV field for making cellular immunity, and many candidates have been chosen in that field, and adenoviruses are very best, and in fact, the Merck adenovirus vector is the one that's being used now in HIV clinical trials for proof of principle, and it's considered the leading vaccine. But the problem with the Ad5 vectors are that about 90% of our subjects in South Africa and around the world have very high neutralizing antibodies against it, while Ad35 doesn't. So this is what the Ad35 looks like. It's got these little spikes on it. The neutralizing antibody is directed against this section. We can take genes out of this and substitute the genes that we want for it so that we can make this virus express TB antigens. And here's the data that shows that the Ad5 here in Africa had very high titers, while very low titers, and actually it's probably less than 5% of people had high neutralizing antibody titers, so it looks like a good candidate. So we designed, constructed, tested animals with Crucell, a vaccine that expresses these antigens, took out the genes that so that the vaccine can't replicate in humans. And it's important to point out that there's a high-affinity CD46 receptor that's been identified that's in humans for this virus. And we immunized mice with this, and you can see that both following BCG, we get very good CD4 and CD8 responses against the three antigens. These are very high titers, 0.5%. In this case, almost 7% of the cells in the spleen were making responses to this. And once again, if we use our recombinant strain, you can see that the recombinant strain gives a much better prime. So this validates our idea that if you use a recombinant strain overexpressing first and then come back with a vector, you can get much better responses than if you use BCG alone, getting to the idea that we'd like to substitute a recombinant BCG and a booster. And then this is just proof that we were able to, just using the adeno alone, protect in animals with two doses, and so the vaccine protects about the same as BCG when given to animals. Now, we did a very long-term guinea pig challenge study where we waited almost 2 years. This is the results of after challenging guinea pigs with saline. You can see that they're all dead. This is the BCG results. This is the result of another vaccine that didn't work, didn't add anything to BCG when it boosted BCG. And this is the results of the Ad35, where you can see toward the end we're getting better responses. When we looked at the pathology here, we found that 77% of the BCG group had 50% or more greater lung involvement as compared to 47% of the Ad35, and this is a result that's highly statistically significant. So adding on to the BCG, the Ad35, gives you a significantly better result in the guinea pig of this vaccine. So we did what you have to do. We did GLP guinea pig toxicology studies, and there weren't any remarkable findings. We also had to do biodistribution results, just like for any other vaccine. We showed that it was fine. There was no problems with biodistribution. And this is the protocol, which is an open-label, non-randomized dose escalation study to evaluate the safety of this vaccine in HIV-negative BCG unvaccinated adults. And it's a dose escalation study in 28 days, and the dose escalation occurs if there's no adverse events after each dose. This is the regimen, four groups, 3 times 10 to the 8th, 3 times 10 to the 9th, 3 times 10 to the 10th in dose escalation. Now, the EU regulators classify this as gene therapy, so we had to do a lot more toxicology, which has delayed it. In fact, we had to find an animal that had the same kind of receptor pattern that humans have. And the animal that we found was the pig. And so we're now vaccinating approximately 4,200 pounds worth of pig in order to do the toxicology study. And we're not sure what to do with all this pork after we finish the study, but I guess if it's successful, we'll have a party. But we didn't have this regulatory problem in the United States, and we passed all the pre-IND process, and I'm pleased to announce that last week the first group of 8 volunteers were vaccinated with this vaccine without any adverse events. And so this is the first time that an Ad35 vectored vaccine has been tested in humans for any disease. I'm particularly proud of this because TB in the vaccine field has always been the stepchild, the poor sister behind HIV and malaria. Now we lead them. We're the leaders in using the best new technology and the HIV field is a year and a half behind us. I think that deserves an applause. We're not competitive, but, you know. And so in summary, new recombinant BCGs have demonstrated preclinical and clinical superiority to BCG. Recombinant BCGs may substitute for BCG or be used as a prime for subsequent booster immunization. The RS-402-AD35 Crucell vector alone and as a boost to BCG or recombinant BCG induces protection and high levels of antigen-specific cellular immunity in animals. And RS-402 has just entered clinical trials as the leading adenovector TB vaccine. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have time for, and also thank you for finishing 2 minutes ahead of time. So we do have time for one or two questions, clarification, if anyone has them. And seeing none, we'll move on to the next speaker. Oh, we do have one slowly walking up to the microphone. Elsa.
Elsa Villarino from the CDC.
Yes.
Could you define protection in animals for me? What is the definition of protection?
Okay. This is a very good question because we don't actually protect animals from getting infection with our vaccines like you normally would see with the normal. What you protect against is the later outcome. And so we define protection compared to the control. In other words, in the long-term guinea pig studies, we could find protection as being alive at the end of the experiment or having less pathology. In the short-term experiments, we can define it as having fewer colony-forming units in the target or lung, liver, and spleen as compared to either saline or BCG, which are comparator. So it's a relative definition, if that answers your question. It's not an absolute. Now, in the primate studies that we're planning to do, we do short-term primate studies where it's, once again, comparing to control the number of organisms that you find in the lung, liver, and spleen and clinical findings. In the long-term primate study, it's actually mortality. So therefore, we see whether or not a primate, having been vaccinated and then challenged, will then live or die at the end of a two-year period. That idea, of course, is that these experiments are very expensive because those animals, once they're challenged, have to be kept under containment so that the organisms don't escape. And if you have to keep them for several years, you can imagine that not that many candidates can be tested. But the definitions are really live or dead, and not whether or not they get infection. So it's a little bit like the HIV field, where in monkeys they look to see what the course of the infection is rather than whether or not they're infected or not.
Thank you.
One last question.
Teresa Mandry with CDC in Botswana. I'd like to ask you to clarify a bit the adenoviral vector. And when folks have, or people have antibodies already against the adenovirus, is that going to neutralize the vector? And you described a little bit, but in a little more detail.
Right. In the case of the adeno-5 vector, which is being tested right now, and it's in about 5,000 people, and trials are going to be started in Africa soon, the evidence is that it neutralizes the virus by about 30 to 60%. So if you have a high dose, you can get around it to some extent. So that's why we felt that starting with a vector where most people don't have neutralizing antibody or have very little, they won't have that effect. This is the big question in the field, whether the pre-existing antibody against the vectors does neutralize them to the extent that they never get into the cell, and so they're not going to be effective, or you can get around that by just increasing the dose above the to a level where it's still safe, and not toxic and still manufacturable. So we thought that starting with AD35, where almost, you know, maybe 20% of people have some neutralizing antibody against it, but most, less than 5% have greater than 200 neutralizing units as compared to AD5, where 90% have greater than 200. We thought we were starting out with something that gave us a chance to better attack that problem. Whether or not it's as big a problem as people thought or not will be only be seen by the end of this Merck trial, which is coming to a close probably by the end of next year.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much for sharing our discussion on new vaccines against tuberculosis. Much of what I wanted to say has already been said by Jerry. We're looking at a BCG, which escapes the endosome Or in other words, we're looking at a BCG that's better, a recombinant BCG that somehow is improved as compared to the currently used BCG. And why do we do that? Well, BCG, we know, is a widely used vaccine, and it has been already summarized. It's very safe, it's very cheap, and it has been used more than 3 billion times globally. And therefore, we thought, since it also protects against childhood tuberculosis, miliary forms, and meningitis forms of tuberculosis, maybe worth to exploit its activity after improvement also for vaccination in a sense that it also protects against adult tuberculosis. So that's the strategy which we performed, which is a strategy that assumes that once a bacterium like tuberculosis is or BCG is taken up by the macrophage, the major host cell, it ends up in the early phagosome. Now all other, most other bacteria would then allow that the phagosome within the macrophage matures, fuses with the phagolysosome, and therefore then is being killed. Not so with the M. tuberculosis pathogen, but also not so much with the BCG, because these two microbes are able to arrest phagosome maturation at an early stage, which means the pH here is rather non-acidic, neutral, and therefore you could argue that this is a nice environment for the microbe to survive within the host, and that's actually what we see in real life. That's the environment where, during latency, the bacteria would survive and persist. For with respect to the immune response, this has consequences. There is still access to the MHC class II antigen presentation machinery, which allows CD4 T-cell stimulation, but there is weak or no access to the CD8 T-cells, at least during the early times of the cell. So we reasoned, if we want to improve BCG, why not think immunologic and improve it by getting better access of its antigens to the MHC1 processing pathway, which allows stimulation of CD8 T cells. After all, I think the whole community agrees that CD8 T cells are relevant to protective immunity. As Jerry very briefly mentioned, there are some recent data from Peter Peters' lab in the Netherlands that M. tuberculosis indeed may egress at a later stage. What we found actually is that M. tuberculosis does not really egress, but induces apoptosis in the host cells at the first 3 or 4 days. Peter Peterson's studies was mostly done with long-term dendritic cells at late stages. And this apoptosis actually leads to the formation of vesicles which have a lot of antigenic cargo. So they include a lot of antigens that come from M. tuberculosis. And these, during the process of apoptosis of the macrophage, are released, are taken up by dendritic cells, which allows for so-called cross-priming, and that is improved stimulation of CD4, CD8 T-cells and all the other T-cells. So we think this is the major trick of M. tuberculosis, to get its antigens to the CD8 T-cells in a form that the CD8 T-cells are stimulated. And actually, it's also a trick to get a better CD4 T-cell response because of the immune system, because cross-priming, of course, also avoids any suppression of the original target cell, the macrophage. So we believe that both antigens can now be accessed. There is one other way in the bacterial kingdom which has been exploited to get CD8 T-cell stimulation, and that's being used by Listeria monocytogenes. This microbe, which is medically not that very relevant, this microbe actually egresses into the cytosol, and in the cytosol now, it can load its antigens on the MHC1 pathway and therefore stimulate CD4 and CD8 T cells, and that is achieved. So if you want to improve BCG, you have two options. You can either increase cell death, and that I call the tuberculosis stratagem, or you increase egression, that's the Listeria stratagem, and in both cases you would get better CD8 T cell responses, in this case even better CD4 responses, and you could of course also always think of both options being combined. We went for the Listeria pathway. We introduced listeriolysin into BCG. Listeriolysin is produced, it seems to perforate the membrane, antigens get out of the phagosome into the cytosol, and indeed this vaccine strain is better than wild-type BCG. However, we were not satisfied because we knew that listeriosine, and Jerry mentioned that briefly, has a very strict pH optimum. It's not really active at the neutral pH, which is created by BCG. Rather, it needs an acidic pH. And actually, perhaps in contrast to Jerry, we think that this is an advantage, that it uses only the acidic pH within the phagosome and therefore will not be active outside of cells. And that's also the original strategy of listeria. So what we had to do to get an optimal pH is to delete urease, the urease C gene, which encodes for urease C. Urease C, as we know from many infectious diseases, catalyzes production of ammonia. Ammonia, of course, neutralizes the pH in the milieu, and therefore listeriosine should now get its acidic pH. That's indeed the case, and therefore we assume that we get better T-cell responses. This is just to show that what I just said is true. This is macrophages infected with BCG, classical, wild type. This is macrophages infected with the recombinant BCG deleted in urease and expressing listeriosine. And as you see by this colored definition or identification of the pH in the phagosome, this is a kind of a red neutral pH. This is a kind of a yellow, quite acidic pH. Since we only had a very short time, I'm not going to show you all the vaccination studies, but want to summarize them in one slide. So what we do now is vaccinate animals, mice, with BCG or the recombinant BCG, that's the parental BCG, wait 120 days, quite a long time, then do a low-dose, intermediate dose, 150 or so bacteria of aerosol infection with M. tuberculosis. We use the H37RV lab strain or a clinical isolate of the Beijing genotype family. And then we wait another 240 days. Why do we use the Beijing family? As you know, these kind of strains, clinical strains, are conquering the world, and they are prevalent in many parts of the world. They're mostly MDR, multidrug resistant, and it has been argued that they developed as MDR Beijing strains because of incomplete compliance, so that those that are MDR are developing because of the incomplete antibiotic chemotherapeutic compliance. And it has been also argued, but never really shown, that the low efficacy of BCG may also have led to strains that are more resistant to the protective immune response against these clinical isolates. So what we did is the experiment. As I said, we did all curves over the whole time period. This is the summary at a late time point. We vaccinate with wild-type BCG and infect with the laboratory strain H37RV, about 10-fold reduction, and that's what you expect. And Peter Anderson also mentioned that it's about a one-log difference. Use our BCG strain, it's at least 10-fold or one log better, and therefore we have about 130-fold reduction at that particular time point in that particular experiment. More interestingly, perhaps, if you use the clinical isolate, the Beijing strain, no protection by BCG. Sometimes we get about 7-fold reduction. That's the best we ever got for wild-type BCG. So indeed, it looks as if BCG may have driven the evolution of Beijing strains to become more resistant against the immune response evoked by BCG. In contrast, our BCG strain, the urease-HLY strain, is still highly efficacious, and in this particular experiment led to a 200-fold reduction. Normally, in scientific talks, I would give the logarithmic data only. I just wanted to illustrate this, that this is quite a dramatic reduction, because what we see indeed is from 1 million or so bacteria, what we normally measure in such an experiment, we go down to 5,000 microorganisms, and that's a 99.5% growth inhibition. So it's quite a dramatic effect that we see. As already also mentioned by Jerry, this strain was found to be more safe or less virulent in a immunodeficiency model. This is the skid mouse, which lacks the acquired immune response. We infect with a rather high dose of the wild-type BCG, and because of that high dose, the skid mice will die around day 20 or so. And if you use the urease listeriosine BCG, they will survive until at least day 120 or so, or even longer. So we have an extreme prolongation of survival of the skid mice, indicating that indeed this strain is safer than the BCG parental strain. We wanted to understand whether our original hypothesis is indeed true, and that is that perforation of the phagosomal membrane leads to antigen dislocation, egression into the cytosol, and it is true. And in fact, we have now developed a methodology which allows us for a kind of quality assessment of the GMP product, looking at the amount of antigen that is being released, which can be quantified quite nicely, and is much higher in the case of the recombinant strain as compared to the parental BCG. What we, however, also saw is that this BCG strain induces apoptosis of infected macrophages, and we assume, therefore, that not only the listeria stratagem holds true, but also the TB stratagem holds true. What we know is that the perforation by listeriolysin, that's known from others, leads to the translocation not only of bacterial antigens, but of course also we are now talking about a phagolysosome of lysosome enzymes, and amongst them is catepsins, notably catepsin D, which is known to activate apoptosis through the conventional caspase cascade. So we believe that actually both mechanisms, which we observed and which I discussed in the beginning, take place and underlie the increased immunogenicity of this strain. Where are we now? We have licensed this vaccine strain to the Vaccine Project Management, which is a German construct that's originally been supported as a kind of foundation by the German government and is supposed to bring academically designed vaccines which they consider worth to pursue into a phase 1, phase 2 trials as a proof of concept. P1 level has been approved, which was, of course, very important by May 2005. So we're now working on a P1 level with this organism. The resistance markers had been removed. As Jerry discussed, at least in Europe, this was a strong argument that we should remove the resistance markers, and actually I also felt better. Pre-GMP production had been started, and the GMP production actually and the safety studies are ongoing now in 2006, and we aim at a phase 1 trial in 2007, mostly now in the hands of VPM, VPM, the Vaccine Project Management. And this is just also to illustrate where we are. We try to get this increased production in the fermentation process, and we're looking for the Clinical 1 program, more or less starting with healthy adult Caucasian, RBCG versus the control, parental BCG. Next step then would be a HD escalation. It was quite gratifying to hear that Jerry assumes that this is a rather rapid process, and then start with the phase 2 trial in a kind of neonate or infant study to come then also in infants in the phase 3 time. As it was mentioned today, particularly by Jerry, but also by Peter, everybody's quite confident. I have a wonderful vaccine in preclinical models. Let's go and test it, and perhaps it will work. But it's more likely, actually, that a prime boost situation will work. I will not really discuss whether this will be a very early boost, as Jerry discussed, or Peter at a later stage. What I would like to say is that sooner or later, I think the best out of it will be if we combine our efforts and our expertise in getting a heterologous prime boost scheme rather than competing. And instead of using BCG here, we would propose to use the best possible recombinant BCG. At this stage, we think our is a good candidate for that. Now, this actually is a long process, as we know. This is a long process to define in clinical trials whether combinations are really better, because you would normally think in a very conventional way, let's first do our phase 1, 2, 3 with the single vaccines and then think whether we can still do combinations. And if you calculate, that's 20, 30, 40 years. So we thought it might also be useful to get biomarkers which could help us to define whether a vaccine indeed induces a kind of a protective immune response. I know that we will never be able to make that a clear statement, but rather whether we will have a biomarker set that allows us, this vaccine induces a protective immune response most likely, so that we might then see whether a vaccine really is a very promising candidate or a less promising candidate. Of course, we believe that interferon gamma produced by antigen-specific T cells is a very important parameter, but we also believe that this is not the only way to tell the full story and that we need additional markers. Let me just call that a biosignature composed of single biomarkers. So what we started with the help of the Bill Gates Foundation is the Grand Challenge 6, which aims at defining biomarkers or biosignatures of protective immunity against TB, notably in the context of HIV/AIDS in Africa, in collaboration actually with ERAS, Cape Town, and Stellenbosch universities in South Africa, with Malawi, the MRC in Malawi, with the Kampala University in Uganda, together with Cleveland, Henry Boom, with Addis, the ARI, and also with the Gambia. And our European collaborators are the Staten Serum Institute with Peter Anderson, his colleagues, ourselves, Tom Mottendorf from Leiden, and Stanford, Gary Skulnik. And the strategy, more or less, which I already mentioned is...
1 minute left.
Yep. 1 minute, you said? Perform head-to-head vaccine trials in a phase two, so, and at that time already try to define whether they give the biosignatures, which we had identified earlier, to see whether we can select the best combination possible, which would mean, of course, we would like to propose to have a head-to-head trial as one part of that. And to show you that this, in principle, can work, a very preliminary study. I would not like to show the antigen data, but I would like to mention that we are now testing 86 to 89 different antigens at the different sites in Africa in a pilot study, and have already identified about 20 or so antigens, which we are considering the most promising one. But we are also going strongly on a transcriptome analysis, where we found actually, if we use at the whole transcriptome of, as you know, 50,000 gene candidates, you can come up with a collection of only three genes to distinguish infected individuals, healthy infected individuals from TB patients, and this is a combination of CD64, RAP33A, and the lactoferrin, which by using deconfounding methodologies already allows you with an 85 to 90% sensitivity to distinguish the two groups of infected versus diseased individuals. And I think this is not only a proof of principle to show that indeed this strategy will help us to define a biosignature composed both of antigen-specific responses and of gene expression profiles. And I think that's where I would like to stop. Let me just thank again the project management, vaccine project management group with Albrecht Läufer, Bernd Eisel, and Leander Grode, and Ali Nassan Edin, Sven Baumann, Volker Brinkmann were really instrumental for doing our vaccine work at the Max Planck Institute in the center of Berlin, very near to the government center, and actually here down where all the soccer activities took place. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
Okay, getting tired.
Very clear presentation, Stefan. Our next speaker then is Helen McShane from Oxford University, who's been working on the MVA candidate vaccine and has very promising data.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jerry. Okay, so I'm going to talk a bit about the clinical trials we've been doing with MVA85A and focus on the more recent trials and the immunology that we've been doing in the last 6 months or so. What does it work? How do I get? Left click. Ah, sorry. Okay, so the vaccine, MVA85A, is an attenuated, MVA itself is an attenuated strain of vaccinia, and we know that this is safe. It was given at the tail end of the smallpox eradication campaign to over 120,000 people. And what we know about MVA and pox viruses in general is that they're very good at boosting previously primed T-cell responses, and that's great for TB because what we have are primed T-cell responses, T-cells that are primed by BCG, but also by environmental mycobacteria. The antigen we focused on, antigen 85A, we've heard a bit about already today. It's one of the leading antigens for inclusion in a new TB vaccine. It's protective in both mice and guinea pigs, and it's extremely immunodominant in both animal and human studies. And importantly, for prime boost strategies, it's present in all strains of environmental mycobacteria and all strains of BCG. Okay, so the way we've designed the clinical studies with MVA85A is to consider a spectrum of mycobacterial load. And because of anxieties about inducing immunopathology in people who are infected with TB, we started with people who were as mycobacterially naive as we could find, so people who were skin test negative and BCG naive. These were adults in the UK. We then moved sequentially through into BCG primed adults, and the study we've recently completed is latently infected adults, people who are actually infected with TB but do not have disease. And in addition, we've conducted all of these studies first in the UK, where there's obviously a low instance of mycobacterial exposure, and then moved them to TB endemic areas in both the Gambia and in South Africa. That's just a summary of the clinical trials that we've conducted to date with this vaccine, most of them in Oxford, some of them in Cape Town, and a couple in the Gambia as well. And the main outcome measure in all of these clinical trials has been safety, and the secondary outcome is immunogenicity. And the main immunological readout we use in all our clinical trials is the ex vivo interferon gamma ELISpot. But what we've done more recently is go back to previous trials where we have frozen samples, and in current trials, done a much more detailed immunological analysis, which I'd like to show you today. So firstly, in safety, we've had no serious or severe vaccine-related adverse events in any of the clinical trials to date with this vaccine, and it's been extremely well tolerated. We see that mild local reactions are common, and this is what we'd expect with this vector. We see that in when this vector is used against other pathogens, and it's an intradermal route of vaccination. We see mild systemic side effects in up to a third of people. These are typically a bit of myalgia, a bit of fever, which resolve spontaneously within 12 to 24 hours. And importantly, we've seen no signs of any immunopathology in any of the people we vaccinated. So moving on to the immunogenicity, as I said, our main immunological readout is the ex vivo interferon gamma ELISpot. And what you see here are the ELISpot responses over time to BCG, which is the blue line along the bottom, and this is to the sum peptide pools. So these are peptides spanning the length of antigen 85A. And BCG typically is very weak at inducing those. The pink line here is MVA alone, so these are in those BCG-naive skin test negative people, and MVA here induces a very strong T-cell response, but it does fall away fairly quickly back to baseline. What's interesting in the prime boost group in people who've had BCG at some point in the past is that you see significantly higher T-cell responses 1 week after vaccination, which is when we see the peak response, but perhaps more importantly for the induction of memory T-cells, 6 months after vaccination, those T-cell responses are still significantly higher. And I should say that this is the highest recorded T-cell response to any T-cell inducing vaccine against any pathogen. We see a broad range of responses across the whole length of this antigen. The responses are not just focused on one or two epitopes within this antigen. These are the individual peptides, and these are the percentage of people who respond to them. And you can see that many of the responses are really highly promiscuously recognized across different HLA types, and that's been reported before with this antigen. Those responses are all CD4 responses, and that's great because for TB, it's very clear that you need a strong CD4 response. But we also see CD8 responses. So if you do a restimulation assay with PBMC from vaccinated volunteers, and here on the right of these panels is their screening sample, and this is in people who've had BCG. So BCG really doesn't do very much in terms of inducing a CD8 response. And then to the left is 2 weeks after MVA. And these are cells that are positive for CD8, interferon gamma, and a known CD8 epitope within antigen 85A. And you can see we're inducing up to 13% of total CD8 T cells are positive for this epitope 2 weeks after vaccination. What Natalie Beveridge in my group has then gone on to do is she's gone to Mario Roederer's lab at NIH and done some work using their new flow cytometry technique to look at the polyfunctionality of these cells. So I've shown you these cells are fantastic at secreting interferon gamma, and we know that interferon gamma is essential for protective immunity against TB, but we also know it probably isn't sufficient, and we need IL-2, we need TNF, we need other cytokines as well. And what she's done here is look at, this is a complicated graph, but if you concentrate on the pie charts across the top, this is pre-vaccination. This is 1 week, 8 weeks, and 24 weeks after vaccination. And the green means cells that are positive for one of the following cytokines, interferon gamma, TNF-alpha, IL-2, and MIP-1 beta. Yellow are cells that are positive for two. Orange are cells that are positive for three, and red are cells that are positive for all four of those cytokines. And you can see that pre-vaccination, i.e. after BCG vaccination, you've really got monofunctional cells that are positive for only one of those four. But after vaccination with MVA85A, the profile changes very dramatically. And even 6 months after vaccination, most of your cells are actually highly polyfunctional. And this, I think, shows quite clearly that we're inducing a very broad TH1-induced immune response with this vaccine, which is what we believe we need for protective immunity against TB. Moving on to the latency study. So these were 12 volunteers who were latently infected with TB. We recruited from TB contact clinics. And what I'm showing you here is the immunogenicity of the latent infection group, and that's the pink bar, compared with the BCG vaccinated group, which is the blue bar. And I think you'll agree there's very comparable immunogenicity in this group. This vaccine is just as safe and just as immunogenic in people who are latently infected as it is in people who've just had BCG. And that's very important as we roll out these studies to the developing world. In that latency study, we also looked in parallel with the interferon gamma ELISpot at the secretion of IL-2 by ELISpot. And you can see there's a really striking similarity between the secretion of IL-2 and the secretion of interferon gamma over time after vaccination. Now, what this doesn't tell you is whether the IL-2 and interferon gamma are coming from the same cell or from different cells, but I think the data I showed you from NIH suggests that actually it's almost certainly coming from the same cell. And that's important as we believe that the IL-2 positive population are the cells that go on to become the central memory population. So everyone agrees in TB that actually the secretion of interferon gamma is vital for protective immunity. And there are three main ways in the field today that people are measuring that. They're using an interferon gamma ELISpot, which is what we're doing in Oxford. Willem Hanekom, now at Cape Town at UCT, has developed a whole blood intracellular cytokine assay, which is a 12 to 18 hour incubation looking at the secretion of interferon gamma. And Hazel Dockrell at the London School in London has developed a whole blood ELISA assay looking at the secretion of interferon gamma using that assay. And what we did was took the opportunity of doing a clinical trial where we used a higher dose of MVA85A to look at the immunogenicity of 10 to the 8 PFU. Our standard dose is 5 times 10 to the 7. To compare those three assays head-to-head on every sample taken at every time point from every volunteer, to ask the question, are these assays giving us similar information or are they giving us different information? And the implication, if we're seeing similar kinetics, is perhaps that they're measuring a similar population of T cells. We also, on four of the volunteers in this, did some CFSE proliferation to look at the proliferative potential of these cells. And the first result, which was a surprise, is that if you give a higher dose, 10 to the 8 compared with 5 times 10 to the 7, you see significantly higher immune responses as measured by ELISpot. These immune responses, I told you a minute ago that these were the highest T cell responses anyone had ever seen against any T cell inducing vaccine. Well, we've just doubled it. And we weren't expecting that to have quite such a significant difference. Looking at the whole blood ELISA data, so this is Hazel Dockrell's assay, you can see that actually what happens is you get a peak response at 1 week after vaccination, just like you do with the ELISpot. And it's almost certain that at the early time points, we are measuring the effector population and the same population we're measuring with the ELISpot here. We will have data going out over the longer time points to see whether if those responses stay up, then that suggests what this assay also picks up later on in time is the central memory population. And then this graph just looks at the proliferative responses. And what you can see, and this is the CD3 positive, CD4 positive subset, and this is using CFSE as a proliferative assay, you can see that actually the proliferative responses peak at 2 weeks rather than 1 week. There is some proliferation, some quite significant proliferation at 1 week, but it's really much more significant at 2 weeks. And you can see that also in the CD4 positive, CD45 RO positive, i.e. the memory phenotype population. And that fits because you would expect the memory population to be coming up as the effectors are dying off. So just to summarize the immunology and the clinical trials I've shown you so far, MVA85A is safe and highly immunogenic in all of the clinical trials we've done to date in BCG-vaccinated and TB-infected subjects. It's highly immunogenic. We see high levels of antigen-specific interferon gamma secretion by whichever assay we choose to use. I haven't shown you the whole blood ICS data yet, as we're still analyzing that. And actually, these cells don't just secrete interferon gamma, but in fact highly polyfunctional with high levels of IL-2, TNF-alpha, and MIP-1 beta as well. And importantly, when we compare those different gamma assays, there's an extremely high degree of correlation between those different gamma assays, which I think suggests that at least at the early time points, it may not matter which assay you use. You can pick your chosen assay to measure your vaccine-induced immunogenicity, but the fact is they're all probably measuring a similar population of cells. So just lastly, to finish on our clinical development plan, we've recently started an HIV study looking at the safety and immunogenicity of this vaccine in HIV-infected people. We're due to vaccinate our first volunteer next week. In the Gambia, we just started a dose-finding and non-interference study in infants, looking at if we give this vaccine at the same time as the EPI schedule vaccines at 16 weeks, does this vaccine interfere with the EPI schedule antibody levels, and do the EPI schedule vaccines interfere with the cellular immunogenicity seen with MVA85A? That's being done in 350 infants in the Gambia. And then in Cape Town, we're conducting an age de-escalation. We've completed the adult arm, and we're going to start the adolescent arm either this week or next week, and then we'll move sequentially into children and infants. In addition, we're conducting some what we've called high-risk groups. So these are adults who will be infected with HIV, infected with TB, or co-infected with both pathogens, and that's going to be in adults. And the reason to do that is then subsequent studies in the age de-escalation and the phase 2B proof of concept will be conducted in everyone, regardless of TB and HIV infection status. And this is just a taster. I haven't had time to talk about the Cape Town studies at all, but this is the immunogenicity from the Cape Town study in adults, and Tony Hawkridge has a poster tomorrow morning which has this study in much more detail that I'd like to recommend. And really, the work I've presented is the work of a large number of people. Just to single out Anne Sopatan, who processed the ELISpots in my lab, Natalie Beveridge, who's done the work at NIH with David Price and Maria Rodera, looking at that polyfunctionality of the cells, the team in Cape Town, particularly Tony Villam and Greg, team at Northwick Park, and the team at the London School. And the work has been funded primarily by the Wellcome Trust with some money from the European Commission. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's very exciting data. Are there any questions for Helen? Stefan.
I really like the polyfunctional cytokines. And it looks as if you have the real subset activated, the IL-2, IF, and gamma. Still, I would like to ask a more general question, not only for your vaccine, but, of course, immunologists or vaccinologists are always happy to get the highest response, but we also know sometimes too much is too bad. It could be bad, at least. I don't have evidence. Do you somehow consider that in your way of thinking? It's part of our analysis.
Absolutely.
Because we also want to associate pathology. I'm not saying that IF and gamma too much is bad.
No.
I just think we have learned that sometimes the right window is equally important.
It's a very real concern in the field, and it's why we've conducted these studies with such caution, moving sequentially up in groups. What I didn't say is in the latently infected study, because we really wanted to show that we weren't inducing any subclinical immunopathology, we actually conducted CT scans pre and post vaccination and saw no change in CT scans after vaccination, i.e. we're not only not seeing any clinical immunopathology, but we're not picking up any subclinical immunopathology either. And I think that's very reassuring.
Yes?
Kirsten Deda, UCL. I just wanted to ask you about the ELISpot assay and the comparison with the polyfunctional assays. In the ELISpot assay, we see different spot sizes. And I wonder if you looked at what these different spot sizes mean in terms of the polyfunctional assays.
We haven't looked at that at all. Generally, I think, overwhelmingly, the responses we see are CD4 responses. And generally, CD4 cells give you bigger spots than CD8 spots. You can now do ELISpots looking at dual function, and we haven't done any of that. We haven't looked at that, no.
Other questions? One thing for the audience, I'd just like to make a couple comments. Because the TB field has evolved and been working for a long time, But unlike other vaccine fields, there isn't really a validated either immunologic measure or animal model that can predict what, with high likelihood, what vaccine might work. In the sense that when we worked on rubella or varicella or many other vaccines, we knew that neutralizing antibodies and their surrogates as ELISA measurements would predict protection, and we were right. But in the case of TB, we don't know for sure. And the stakes are fairly high because to do an efficacy trial, even in a high attack rate that we see in South Africa or in India or in other parts of Africa, we estimate would take up to 14,000 subjects comparing BCG to the control in infants. And it's even worse in the adolescent trials like Peter was describing, because that might take up to 25,000 adolescents. There's lots of TB everywhere, but it occurs over a whole lifetime, so the incidence isn't that high. So to mitigate this risk, our strategy, and I think Helene's and others, is to try and do what we would call small proof-of-principle trials, not to slow down the progress of the program, but to rather make sure that when we make the commitment to do these very large trials, we have some idea that it might work. And then there's another reason for that. Vaccines, in contrast to drugs, the factories that you have to build for them are very specific to the very vaccine. And so it requires not only a clinical investment, but an investment in the factory at the time that you start the phase 3 trials, because it takes about 3 to 5 years to build and validate a factory. And the worst thing we would want would be to have a vaccine that would have been proven to work and we couldn't deliver it into the developing world. That would not be a good thing. So these proof of concept trials, we feel, based on the work that you heard from Tony, if you notice, those incidences are somewhere between 1 and 4%. So that means then about in around 700 children with a control group of equal size, we could actually get, using the broader definition, a proof of concept on some of these vaccines so that we could put that into the equation along with the animal data and the immunogenicity and the manufacturing and product profile characteristics in order to decide which candidates should go into phase 3. So I think that there's an overall plan that most people buy into that we should try this approach so that we can deliver not necessarily the best vaccine that could ever be made, but at least we could get something that looks promising now into phase 3 trials and licensed in the 2014 timeframe, which seems a long time away, but really isn't. And I think that if we did that, we could make an enormous impact. I mean, I'm very excited about all the candidates that were presented here. They all look very promising, and we certainly want to support all of these candidates to see whether or not they're, you know, they would make the grade, so to speak, to go into the large phase 3 trials, which obviously there can only be a few of those because they're so big. So we're hoping to make it a somewhat rational but somewhat empiric approach, a combination of the two based on the knowledge that we have now. And then I think there's a lot of work going on in the grand challenges and in the basic science community to try and understand the reactivation from the latency state. Since there's 2 billion people infected, we'd love to make a vaccine that could prevent that reactivation. And we're hoping that the knowledge that is gained both in the programs that are going on now as well as the programs that are going on, we can make vaccines in the future that could do that. The other thing is that a vaccine might not only prevent infection, but as Peter Anderson's pointed out, a vaccine might also prevent someone that gets infected but doesn't have disease from going into the latent state. And so preventing the latent state itself would be a wonderful thing that a vaccine could do. So on the whole, I think, at least I feel, that there's enormous excitement in this field. There's lots of good candidates, and there's a good future that in the fairly near future in terms of the vaccine timeframes, we should have something that might be better.
Yeah.
Right, so that's the vaccine part. Now we'll talk about...
Well, and Jerry had talked about impact, which that's a good segue into a presentation by Professor Dick Menzies from McGill University in Canada, who has done a lot of modeling work in the past and most recently has been looking at the potential impact of different technologies, and specifically here we'll be talking about new TB vaccines.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you, Jerry. So I have, some particular challenges. One is to kind of close off the afternoon. Everybody's getting tired and itching for the door. And the other is I sort of feel a bit like a foreign body here, coming after all these high-level talks, and now I'm going to talk about something that's really quite, so now for something completely different, so to speak. Okay, so I'm going to run through kind of a decision analysis or cost-effectiveness analysis 101, why and how, a little bit about at least how I think new vaccines could act when I, again, from a modeling perspective perhaps, some of the methodologies we're going to look at, we're going to model in two countries, the application in India and China, and then some of the results and sensitivity analyses. So conceptually, at least again, bear with me, those who have given the preceding talks. So a new vaccine could act either at the time of exposure to prevent infection, or could act after infection to prevent the development of disease, or potentially could act here to prevent late reactivation, or possibly, since there's a lot of second exposure and reinfection in high-incidence countries, perhaps it could act out here after reinfection, reducing the risk of disease after reinfection. Okay, so I've kind of talked about that. I think all I'll say is that natural infection or immunity, as I understand it, probably acts in here, so that when after reinfection, your risk of developing disease is substantially lowered. And BCG vaccination, I think also, as I understand it, acts by mechanism number two. Okay, so what parameters, when we're talking about modeling, what parameters will affect the outputs of modeling? Well, obviously efficacy, but I think it's also, is the vaccine going to prevent the early development of disease within the first 2 or 3 years? Is it going to have any impact on the later development, late reactivation? Is it going to have any effect in previously infected? Again, in early infection after early disease after reinfection or late reactivation? So these are kind of key questions that, again, influence a lot. And this is sort of where we focus the modeling. Is in looking at these different dimensions, if you will. The other key parameter that we've examined is age when given. Because if the vaccine is given only in infancy, as you can imagine, there's a long lag before there's a substantial epidemiologic impact. Because, again, children, if they develop TB, are not that infectious, and it's only really when they reach adolescence and young adult life that they begin, that they really contribute to the transmission. There also may be some arguments in terms of how you model the economic impact of childhood tuberculosis versus adolescent and adult tuberculosis. Again, when in low-income countries, it's really the adolescents and young adults that are the most economically active and therefore have the greatest economic impact when they're disabled or die. So if it's given at all ages or potentially up to the age of 30 or in adolescence or whatever, as people have talked about, there's a much more immediate epidemiologic impact in terms of reducing cases and thereby reducing transmission. And, of course, the reduced mortality can have an immediate economic impact. But when modeling these kinds of things, the issues that are also key are safety and HIV infected. So, again, I've not even considered the issues of efficacy. Simply whether it can be given safely to HIV infected. If it can't, then you have a whole new order of complexity and cost. And complexity, as we know, diminishes compliance as well as the cost. If it's not safe in HIV infected, then you're down to giving it only in infants and children. So for this modeling, we have assumed that the vaccine would be safe. Just made that assumption. As you heard in the preceding talks, there's a lot of work to make sure about that. What about if they're already infected with latent TB? If it's safe for the already infected, then you can indeed envisage giving it to all ages and safely, and you don't need to screen for latent TB infection. If it's unsafe, then either, again, you're back to the infants or you have to screen, adding, again, cost and complexity. And then finally, there's the actual complexity of the vaccine itself, one dose, multi-dose. And I just show you some data from sort of EPI data from the field in India. When you have one dose, what kind of compliance or success you have in getting children immunized, and three doses, one dose, three dose, one dose, five doses. So obviously, the more doses of vaccine that you're contemplating giving, the lower your population impact will be. Again, setting aside issues of cost, just looking at likely compliance. Okay, so why decision analysis? Well, first of all, clinical data, clinical trials, usually focus on a single intervention, and again, often at a single age. And in this case, I think decision analysis, again, it's obviously there's a lot of wild guesses that have to go into the inputs, but when you're trying to compare the impact, what it would be if you gave it in infancy versus older, then decision analysis, I think, can be helpful, again, in comparing, not in necessarily absolute numbers, not in you're going to save X billions or cost X billions, but more which strategy would be better than another. So, again, it allows for prediction, what will happen if you take alternate courses of action, and the process, again, involves building a credible series of events after each decision or choice. So, obviously, very important in all this, and really what often drives and can be either the strength or the weakness of these analyses is the choices in terms of probabilities, particularly where there's a lot of uncertainty. When you have multiple randomized trials that say the efficacy of this drug is 75%, then there's not much uncertainty in using that assumption. But in obviously in vaccines, there's a lot of uncertainty at the moment. Okay, so how do we do this? And I'll kind of go through this again very quickly. So we used a decision analysis model using multiple Markov processes or a Markov model. I'll just show you a very simplistic example. So someone here has latent TB. They can reactivate, remain with latent TB, die of another cause. If they reactivate, they can be cured, or they can fail. If they fail, they come back around to persistent TB. Later, they can die, et cetera. If they're cured, they can come back around to cured TB. They can be reinfected, et cetera, or relapse. Am I going up or down? So, of course, that was a very simple model. I'm not showing this to be clear. In fact, I'm showing it deliberately to be unclear, perhaps. Just to say that as you build the model, each choice is followed by other choices. Each probability is followed by other probabilities. So that someone here, for example, is entering with recent latent TB infection. There's various things that can happen to them. They can develop TB and so on. And so you move through, and then people will cycle back around. So in a given, for 1 year, all this can happen. The following year, they can cycle back around. So it can get fairly complex. But at each stage, there are probabilities that are usually as much as possible derived from published literature. Okay, what we did here was we took a 20-year time frame, thinking that, you know, for a vaccine, you're looking at a long-term payback. We also used what's called discounting. So that means if you vaccinate this year, you pay for your vaccines, presumably. But if your TB is prevented that would have occurred 10 years from now, that savings, if you will, is worth less because of the discounting. So things that happen 20 years away are worth a lot less than things that happen this year. It's just a kind of convention for model. But it is important, especially when we come to the infancy versus older, discounting actually plays a role as well in the kind of benefits or lack of benefits, if you will. We conducted the analysis from the societal perspective. That means health system costs, so how much for diagnosis and treatment of TB, how much for vaccination, obviously. But we also look at costs from disability and particularly mortality, because mortality from undiagnosed TB is obviously still very important in many low-income countries. And we considered two high-burden countries, India and China, and I'll come to the epidemiologic parameters. The outcomes, we looked at TB cases, TB mortality, the cost of development of new vaccines, procurement, training, administration, cost for TB cases. We did not model secondary cases, which tends to make any prevention strategy like vaccine less beneficial. Don't tell me I only have a minute. Okay. As I mentioned, efficacy will be varied, age of vaccination be varied. The other things were basic assumptions. Assume safe in HIV, assume safe in TB infected, and one dose with 100% compliance, i.e. 100% coverage. Optimistic assumptions. Okay, I'll just move on quickly, as I see. Just to say that, again, many of the basic assumptions about pathogenesis of TB, who would develop TB, how rapidly, and so on, were taken from published literature. So I'll just skip, again, right on through. Epidemiologic parameters, I don't think I need to, again, cover them too much. I would point out, though, HIV seroprevalence is very low in both countries, and that so that the fact that we assumed HIV would have no efficacy but would be safe, again, in these two countries is of relatively little importance. We also assumed quite low case detection rates, and annual risk of infection is based on the Stiblo formula from the incidence of smear-positive TB. So at a 1.5% per year risk, it means a 15-year-old might have around 20% prevalence of latent infection. And in China, this would be, I guess, around 10 or 11%, maybe 12%. Okay, TB control parameters, we assumed basically well-functioning DOTS programs. I could summarize with that. Costs. So I could say here that I just took a wild leap. Actually, I asked Larry last year for some detailed estimates of cost of developing a new vaccine, and he labored away for days to produce it. But I rounded up all his numbers to an even $1 billion. Sorry. But this includes everything. It includes the winners and the losers, if you will, because you have to sort of, you can't just count the cost for the one vaccine that or two vaccines that make it through. You have to consider all the costs that went into developing ones that didn't finally make it. And we, for the moment, I took a cost per vaccine dose of $5, which was varied, and I'll show you some of that. Vaccine administration would be only $2 in India, $4 in China, assuming differences in salary, basically. And a TB case, again, these are based on some extrapolations, but how much it would cost per TB case. Again, we assumed an efficacy of the vaccine of 80%. For the base case, and we varied the countries and the age and the action. So I'll show you this. Okay. So first of all, the predicted TB cases based in fact on a steady incidence would be 17 million cases in India and 11.5 million cases in China over 20 years. If the vaccine is given only to newborns, and prevents only early disease, i.e. occurring in the first 2 to 3 years after infection, a modest reduction in both countries. If it prevents early and late reactivation, again, a modest effect, a little added benefit of that. On the other hand, if it was given at all ages, it would prevent much more cases. And, of course, because many people are latently infected, a vaccine that would act against both would have a greater effect as well. Okay, so just looking at the reduction, so in case you weren't able to quickly do the math, a vaccine given to newborns over 20 years would prevent 2.5 million cases in India and a little over 2 million in China. A vaccine that would be given at all ages, on the other hand, would prevent 8 million cases in India and just under 7 in China. So something that can be given older would have a much greater impact, in large part because of the 15, we assumed a 15-year lag, just for simplicity. Given at zero, only start to work at age 15. Again, it's simplifying things a bit, but it's sort of necessary sometimes with this analysis. Now, what about the total costs? So with DOTS, 100% coverage in India, expected TB-related costs, a lot of which is societal costs from mortality of TB would be $35 billion, and in China, almost $47 billion. The vaccine given to newborns, this is the costs, so this is the total cost. So you see actually the costs are higher, so this is the, and I could say also that I attributed the $1 billion, half to India, half to China. So there's a $500 million in here just for the development costs, but the rest is administration costs. These are obviously, even at $5 a unit cost, it's a huge cost. So what you see is that costs go up for the vaccine given to newborns, but there's substantial savings in the vaccine given at all ages, related, of course, to the large reduction in cases. So again, because it's hard to do the math, so again, here's the total costs in the two countries and the total. So if the vaccine's given to newborns and prevents early disease only, you add, as you see, about $12 billion in cost in the two countries from the vaccination. If it prevents early and late disease, your total added cost is $9 billion, so it's less. On the other hand, if it's given at all ages, then you're starting to see huge savings. This is $24 billion in savings. And if the difference is a bit less in terms of the prevents early and late disease, but still you see a total of close to $30 billion. So huge savings. But again, it's not so much the actual savings, it's the difference in the strategies that I think is more relevant because the actual dollar amounts are so hard to decipher. So a little bit of sensitivity analysis. So what if the vaccine has different efficacy? We assumed 80% as the maximum. But what if, of course, if it's zero, you don't do much. But this is given at the age of 15, again, in the model, and it prevents early disease only. So even at 20% efficacy, you can see you're starting to prevent 2 million cases and so on. It's a simple bit of math. Perhaps if it prevents early and late disease, it's a marginal difference. But now perhaps more interesting is looking at the cost or savings. So this is the same analysis, the new vaccine. So when the vaccine has no efficacy, of course, you just add the costs of the vaccine. You don't gain anything, so you're obviously spending more money. But the line crosses zero, so it sort of becomes even, when the vaccine efficacy for China is around 30%, a little under 30%. And it crosses the zero line a little above 40% for India. And again, this is only assuming that all of the development costs were loaded onto two countries. So all of that to say that the vaccine efficacy, if it can be given at an older age, doesn't have to be super fantastic. I mean, better, obviously, if it's 80% or better. But even at what people would consider rather borderline efficacy, it's still going to have a very substantial impact, epidemiologic and economic. Okay, this is, again, given early or late disease. So if it prevents both forms, it'll do a little better. But, again, it's relatively small. Now, what about if we vary the cost of the vaccine, as you can imagine? And now here I applied it to given in infancy, since we already had shown that if you give it at an older age, you achieve savings. I thought it was a little more interesting to look at given in infancy and you vary the unit cost. So this is total unit cost, so administration and the manufacturer's cost. And you see that, again, given in infancy, for China, when the cost is around $5, you're beginning to break even for China for a vaccine given only in infancy. In India, on the other hand, you're not breaking even at a cost of $1. Again, this reflects lower average income, high mortality, but again, the 15-year lag for the benefit from given in infancy. Okay, I'll skip that. So to summarize, so a new vaccine could be cost-saving within 20 years if given to adolescents or young adults, if it prevents early disease, and has efficacy of at least 30% in China or 40% in India. Cost savings will be better or greater, obviously, if efficacy is greater. Will be somewhat better if it prevents early and late disease. Obviously, again, if the unit cost is lower, cost savings will be greater. Used in more countries. Again, I assume this rather large development cost, but then only applied it to two countries. Of course, if you're vaccinating the whole world, then that cost gets spread over more countries. And so an analysis that included more countries would have looked a little better. On the other hand, cost savings will be less if you can give it only in infancy, for safety issues, for example, because of the long lag before there's any epidemiologic or economic impact. And again, if the unit costs are higher, then cost savings again go down. So if the unit costs turn out to be $15 a unit per vaccine dose, then it's going to be a lot harder to see cost savings or take longer. So again, just from this, again, very simplistic analysis, I would say that the greatest benefit will be from a vaccine that is safe in HIV-infected, safe in already TB-infected, and has some efficacy against adult pulmonary TB, so that it can be given safely to adolescents and young adults. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank all the speakers for being on time. Besides the impressive work that's been done so far, you know, it's very surprising that we had 6 very capable speakers, and they all stayed within time. And I think we can open the floor just to general questions for anyone. And Helen has a question for Dick. Don't go away, Dick.
Hi. Can I just ask you, your model assumes one new vaccine. Did you look at if you'd actually introduced two new vaccines, what were the cost implications of that? So if you introduced a new BCG and a boost?
No, we didn't. We assumed it would be like a boost kind of thing.
Sure.
Added to BCGs already being given. So we didn't actually factor that in. It was just one new dose. So, I mean, after today's talk, I probably will. For me or?
Elsa?
Professor Menzies, how does the...
That way.
It makes things look better for the vaccine, because any reduction in cases should lead, of course, to reduced transmission, which in turn will lead to reduced future cases. So by us, again, this is a kind of a simplistic model for the moment, given that we don't know too much about all the vaccines that will come out. So it's a bit, if anything, it's conservative in terms of its projections of savings and epidemiologic impact. It'll make the vaccines look better. I'm not sure about the model, but the vaccines will look better.
Stefan.
Actually, one comment, if you don't mind. First, I think you should also have included whether a vaccine works in HIV-infected. As you know, TB risk is really increased several hundredfold in HIV co-infected, so it's also likely that a vaccine may not be as good, which I think is one more parameter. But the real question was, how do you define the efficacy of a vaccine? If you say 40% makes sense, is that 40 of 100 are protected, and how long, or...
Okay, sure. We assumed that, again, in the model, we split people into new TB infection, and then they have a certain risk of TB, which we actually round off to 5% in 2 years. And then after that, they go down to a lifelong lower risk of 0.1% per year for the rest of their lives, as long as they survive and don't die of something else. So in all this early disease, we said it's an 80% reduction, so instead of a 5% risk of disease, it's a 1% risk of disease in the first 2 years.
Yeah.
And just to comment...
So really again, talking about diseased versus non-diseased, not less less heavy disease? Or,
oh, no, right. Yeah. It's you get it or you don't. It's an all or nothing. And we assume that if you got it, it would be the same as someone who wasn't vaccinated. And just to comment, the HIV... I mean, you're quite right. It would be interesting. It's at the, again, you know, we sort of took the more conservative route. So we said HIV, it's not going to work at all and left it at that. Of course, if there's any data that says that it does work or the efficacy is a bit less, that can be easily plugged into the model.
Well, one comment and a question. The comment is that taking into account what you've said, the strategy is to do both, a pediatric and an adolescent. And I think I've made a very strong case to our funders that to just do pediatrics would not be useful because of that 15-year gap between even if it worked in the even if you vaccinated a pediatric, it worked in the other age group, you'd have that long gap. My question is, in your analysis, since the development of the vaccines is being funded almost primarily outside of the groups that fund the treatment, in other words, there's a difference. Why do you combine them? In other words, is the funding, the $1 billion could be essentially, it's not like a commercial development where you have to make the money back that was invested. It's money that's put in but doesn't have to be made back. So why does that count?
So a little bit, the original premise of what we're doing is that we're looking at if governments, like the government, the Netherlands?
Yes.
Makes an investment in vaccine development, what will be the payback, if you will?
Nice.
And, of course, it is more complicated because the healthcare costs are borne in India and China, by and large, and yet the vaccine development. So ultimately, we will also be looking at the somewhat cynical view from the Netherlands or other high-income countries that receive migrants from those countries and looking at that analysis as well.
Okay. Are there other questions?
Also, I think we've, at least according to my watch, we've come to the end of the symposium. I'd like to thank all those who attended. Again, thank all the speakers. And I'd also like to take this opportunity, if you can just wait 1 second, just to point out that in the back of the abstract book in the advertising section, there is a notice from ARIS that we're looking for areas in Asia and South America to develop new TB vaccine sites. And it just gives a very brief summary of what we're looking for, and gives you an email address to ask for the whole RFP, so that anyone here who knows someone, knows some group, works at some group, or is an individual with an agency meets the criteria for that that's described there in that announcement, I'd ask you to take a look at the RFP and consider putting in a proposal. And thank you again to everyone.